I'm Marietta Mattingly, and I'm a member of the Al-Anon Family Groups.
Amen.
Thank you. It truly is an honor and a privilege to be asked to speak at a roundup or any time in Al-Anon or do any part to be a service of our program. And I thank you from the bottom of my heart. Thank you, Milton, and your committee and the roundup here. I'm from Bardstown, Kentucky. It's a small town, 40 miles south of Louisville. I wasn't always from Bardstown. I was from a rural area in a very small spot in the middle of the road in rural area of Washington County. So I want to tell you my home group is the Bardstown Thursday Night Group. It's the only home group I've ever had. And I've been in Al-Anon since May of 1979. And I'm coming up on my 20th year in Al-Anon. And I'm so grateful that I was one of those Al-Anons that stayed with the program. Because this is, you know, when my life was in shambles when I got here. The only problem that I had was to fix the alcoholic. And I would have told you I was fine. I did all the right things when I got here, and he did all the wrong things. I was so perfect. I mean, there weren't nothing wrong with me. I had a lot of learning to do when I got here. I need to tell a little Al-Anon joke. I wasn't going to tell it because I have a lot of respect for the chapel that we're in here today. It's not really dirty, but it's hairy. But after Ro told that one, it set the tone for me to tell this one. It seems that this lady went to see her doctor, and he just gave her a real good report, said she was in real good condition and was real healthy, and she had a face of an 18-year-old. So that night when she came home, she was standing in front of the mirror, and she was pushing up on her hair and just a prison in front of the mirror, and her husband saw her, and he said, "Honey, what on earth are you trying to do?" She said, "Well, I went to the doctor today, and he gave me a good report and said I had a face of an 18-year-old. He said, "Yeah, but honey, did you tell him about that 40-year-old rear end you had?" She said, "No, honey, we didn't talk about you." So, with that in mind, the Al-Anon program says we must keep the focus on us. In our preamble, it says that we're not to talk about the alcoholic. Now, I didn't know I had anything wrong with me, and the only thing that was wrong in my life was to fix the alcoholic in my life. So I knew they didn't know. They hadn't caught on yet. So I was in to inform them that I was Miss Perfect, and I knew it all, and there was nothing wrong with me. And it took me 2 years in the program to gasp for this program. It really did. But I didn't grow up in alcoholism. I was very naive, and I had a lot of learning to do about alcoholism. In this little rural area, my father kept us very isolated from they didn't socialize with the community, and they didn't have a lot of friends. My mother and father we were other life. I was the oldest of four children, and being the oldest does a lot of things to you. It's almost like being the youngest, but the oldest, I had a lot of responsibility. I learned to be accountability. I learned a lot of things that I could do things and get it done and be responsible. I really was over-responsible about a lot of things in my life. But my parents would leave and go to shopping or anything they wanted done. They could say, "Now, Marietta, you're the oldest. You know what to do." They gave me a lot of leeway in my life because I really knew that I knew what was best for everybody. Everybody. I knew the right thing to do because my parents told me I knew what to do. So I had a lot of unlearning to do. Especially after I came to Al-Anon and learned that I did not know what was best for everybody. So it's a hard job. It really is thinking you know that what's best for everybody. But my parents was loving parents. I didn't grow up thinking that I was unloved and that nobody cared and have low self-esteem, because my parents really did love me and loved. And my father was an orphan, and hearing Jan's talk last night brought me back a lot of memories. Hearing my father speak of his childhood, because it was similar to the childhood that she grew up in, and my father loved his family. He loved my mother, and he told her he loved her, and he loved us, and I mean, I just couldn't have been loved no more. My father was a very special person in my life, and he was my favorite. I don't mind saying that today. Both of my parents are gone, and they both passed away since I've been in Al-Anon, but my mother was a person that did everything that my father wanted her to do. It didn't matter. My father and mother just loved each other, and my mother worshiped my father, and it was a good atmosphere, I think, to grow up in, because I didn't feel unloved, and my sisters and I, we just loved each other a lot. We really did. We knew how important a family was and a home life, and it was a long time in Al-Anon before I came to that, and a lot of things in Al-Anon comes to me that today that I didn't realize that was the way it really was, because when I grew up, I thought, I hated living on the farm because there was always so much work to do, and I wanted to be like the other children and go to movies and ball games and do all the things that they were doing, and I never got to do a lot of that. Very little of that I got to do, because we didn't celebrate holidays. I never celebrated Thanksgiving until after I was married, because you know what we did Thanksgiving Day? We stripped tobacco. We lived on the farm, and honey, they were chores to do every holidays. We didn't go on picnics or fishing or anything. We had, you know, the fun things we did, I remember, was playing cards together. We did a lot of that. We on Sundays, we would go to church, and I was taught, to, you know, we went to Mass. You know, we were going to hell if we didn't. So, you know, we got there every Sunday. No matter what, we went to church. Then on a Sunday afternoon, we probably visit relatives. And we didn't live close to any of our relatives, so we had to drive quite a distance to visit our relatives. So it was a real treat to have them to come visit us and seeing our cousins and things like that. So I really did grow up being very isolated and naive to the world. I had a grandmother. My mother was a Nelson County girl, my grandmother lived in Bargetown. And every summer, I always spent a couple of weeks with my grandmother. And it was a real treat to go there and visit and be with someone else. But this October in 1955, when my grandmother had her birthday dinner, my aunt, I went to my grandmother's with my family to have the birthday dinner, and my aunt had asked her best friend to come to my grandmother's birthday dinner, and she brought her son. I was 13 years old. This is when I met the alcoholic that's in my life that I have been deeply affected when I was 13. He was absolutely the most charming thing I ever had met. He chased me through the house. I was in the eighth grade. I thought he was so sweet. He pulled my ponytail. And he just did a lot of things that attracted me so much to him. He was just special. That's all it was to it. Well, after a couple years, the summer that I was 16, I went back for my yearly visit to Bargetown to visit my grandmother, and I remet him all over again. Now, this is when we started dating. He had grew so tall. I thought he was so tall, and he was so handsome. And, oh, was he ever so witty. He had the most charming personality. I just fell head over heels in love with him. I always knew from the very beginning I wanted him. I truly wanted him for me. But I never always felt that he felt that way about me. But you know how we are. I set out to show him and to try to make him believe I was a good catch for him. And I worked real hard at that. We did date for a couple years, but in our dating years, there was no alcohol. Now, I grew up in a little small community that was Baptist, and they didn't drink. Honest, I didn't know Baptists drank, because they didn't in my community, and I didn't know anything about drinking. But once in a while, I would hear the boys at school say, we went to Lebanon, and we went to Golden Horseshoe, and we did this and did that. And I thought, what are they talking about? They didn't fill me in on what went on there. So I didn't know for a long time what went on at those places. But during our drinking years, I had no idea that my husband had even had a drink of alcohol and that he'd ever drank. But we were dating for about a year, and he came to visit me, and he announced to me that he had joined the United States Navy. Now, I had another year of high school to finish, and he had just graduated from high school, and I was really crushed because, see, I knew the world was great big out there for him, and I knew the opportunities were greater for him, and I knew he would never come back and marry this poor little old country girl that I thought I was. We wrote to each other, and I don't think I ever laid eyes on him between the whole year, maybe a couple times, but I remember they were very slim, and I didn't know a whole lot about what went on with him when he was in the Navy. Only thing I knew is what he wrote on paper, and you know he didn't write a whole lot on paper, and so I didn't know a whole lot what was going on in his life. But we were married after he was in the Navy for 1 year. I graduated from high school on the following November, on the 19th, which was Thursday. 38 years ago, we got married. So we were here Thursday night to celebrate our anniversary. Thank you. After we were married a couple of weeks, he got orders for Guantanamo Bay in Cuba, and I stayed in Bargetown and lived with his folks and got me a job at the local factory, and he went off to fight the war, I guess. He went to Cuba. For one whole year, I hadn't laid eyes on him, and I didn't know a whole lot. You know, letters just don't tell you a whole lot. We miss you, and we still love you, and we think about you, and that's about all the letters said, but I wrote every day. If you had a copy machine, you probably could have run copies, and I'd had, it was the same thing every day, I'm sure. But anyway, when he came home on the plane at Stanford Field in Louisville, Kentucky, his mother and I were so excited. We hadn't seen him for a whole year. And I know he came home like 2 in the morning. I think the plane arrived in Louisville. But we drove down to Stanford Field. We went real early. We waited in the airport forever to see him because I hadn't laid eyes on him for a whole year. And I remember him coming down them steps on the plane. And you know, they didn't have that jet walk like we have today to the planes. You could see him come down them steps. And I remember him in that sailor uniform. And I thought, my God, Marietta, you have married the most handsome guy in the whole United States Navy. And when he got inside that building and he hugged me, I thought he smelled ucky. He smelled so awful. I had never smelled that smell before. What on earth is sour? It smelled like sour mash, I know today. But I had no idea. He just smelled terrible. But I remember he acted so crazy. He was just silly. You know, he did act like he had some dignity about him, and he had some maturity and intelligence, and he was just crazy. I mean, silly. And I'd never been around him been this silly before. And with one of his permission, I can say that I thought he was just horny because I had no idea that, you know, we hadn't been together for a whole year. Why not? That's what I thought. But anyway, for the next 15 days of my life, it was going to be a way of life for another 15 or 20 years, and I had no idea. See, I had no idea. I didn't know this man. when he announced to me that he wanted to go to the bars and drink with the guys and be with people that I didn't know and things that I didn't want him to do and had no idea, I just knew for sure that he was going to be every awakened moment with me while he was home. He was going to tell me how much he loved me, how much he missed me, and I had a line of things that we were going to do. We were going to do this and do that. And I was just crushed that he was wanting to go to the bars and drink with the guys. I had no idea what was going to go on in my life or his life. And I remember the very first time he went drinking into the bars, and I thought he stayed too long. He stayed too long, much longer than I thought he should stay. And I went looking for him the very first time. When they got it, I got in Al-Anon, and they talk about they went looking for him, but they never told me they went the first time that you knew that he ever went to the bars and drank. And I did. And it was a way of life for me of many, many days and years afterwards, because a lot of years I spent looking for him, wondering where he was and who he was with, and wondering if he really wanted to be with them more than he wanted to be with me. So I had a lot of awakening to do. But after he got orders for Lurkhurst, New Jersey, I went with him, and this was the first time we ever started living together as a husband and wife. I think they do it reverse today, don't they? Live together, then get married. We got married, then it was a long time before we lived together. So we've got it. We had things turned around for a long time. But we start living together, and it's husband and wife, and going to have a little girl. We had a little girl in New Jersey, and I remember he wasn't even 21, because we were just 18 when we got married, and he couldn't go to the bars and drink in New Jersey, and I was happy about that, but he did get liquor at the base, and they had a squadron party there, and I remember how he got behind and drinking his beer, and how they were teaching him, because he was getting out of the Navy, and they wanted him to ship over and stay in the Navy another 4 years, and all this stuff. It was just crazy to me when we went to the Christmas party there that year, and I remember that was the first time I ever saw my husband drunk, and it was an unbelievable experience for me to know that he wasn't in control of himself and the things that he did. And I remember them wanting to do the limbo, and he wanted to do the limbo, and he wasn't this far from the floor, and I knew I didn't want to pick him up, and I didn't want nobody else to pick him up, because I knew he couldn't get under that limbo stick. And I remember how I was embarrassed and how I was ashamed of the way he acted when he drank. From the very beginning, I didn't like what he did when he drank. But that night when we came home to they call it a bungalow back then. It was one of those shotgun houses, you know, the living room, the bedroom, and the kitchen's all they had, and a bathroom. And that was, everybody lived like that. Everybody had a house like that there at the Naval Air Station. So when we got up those steps, I remember how I had to hold on to him and get him up the steps. And we got in the house, and he got so sick. Oh, he vomited. And I thought, you know, as a little girl, I grew up on the farm, and we had cows that would eat an old weed that would make them sick, and they wouldn't eat that weed no more. My father talked about it a lot. And besides, as a little girl, I ate a bunch of fudgesicles one time at a picnic, and fudgesicles made me sick. And you know, today I don't eat fudgesicles. So I thought, good, he's not going to drink anymore because he's sick, you know. But my husband loved to drink, and he loved to vomit. He loved to do that. He did it over and over. One time I asked him if he didn't like to do that, because he did a lot of it. But after he got out of the Navy and we moved back to Bardstown, and I went back to my old job and went to work, we bought this little white frame house, had little white picket gates, and Billy drove a milk truck for a while and for a couple of years, and things just rocked around real good for us. You know, it pretty much did what I thought it would do. And you know, in Nelson County, the bourbon capital of the world, people there drink beer like we drink Pepsi Colas from where I came from. And, you know, I kind of eased into this disease and this illness just gradually. It did not happen overnight. I just didn't wake up one night and it banged on me. It's just that I was an easy-led person, and I thought my parents didn't know how to have fun. They never had fun. They didn't know how to live. And we were having a lot of fun by this time. We were inviting people in our homes, and we were going to other people's homes, and I had started drinking a few beers and having those fruity drinks that were so tasty, and I just loved them. Now, I know what it's like to be drunk. I've been drunk a couple times, and I don't know why you would ever want to do it more than twice. I've had a headache, and one time I remember it was New Year's Eve, and I couldn't get my food to get in my mouth. I had these eggs up, and they were going here, going here. I was just embarrassed to tears because I couldn't get them eggs to get in my mouth, and I just don't know why it would ever happen to anybody, but more, you know, I know today, since I've been in Al-Anon, that it's because I'm not in control when I drink. That's why I don't like drinking. So I just wasn't for me. But we did have a lot of fun with it, and we just partied and no end. I mean, we lived from weekend to weekend and did a lot of things that revolved around drinking. And if we went to the lake, we would fill the truck up and the camper up, and we would, first thing would be there would be the beer, and it would probably be the last thing that we'd take off. And it was just a good time, I guess, in our lives. But by the time we were married 8 years, and my husband had went to work at Ford Motor Company, and by this time in Louisville, and we had a little boy. We had a little girl and a little boy by this time. And you know that George Jones song, you know, the country music songs. He wrote 8 years and 2 children later. And if he didn't hit the spot in my life, because when I was married 8 years, alcoholism was a problem for me. Now, it wasn't for my husband. He was having a good time. He was really enjoying life, and he was always the life of the party. People loved him. They thought they couldn't figure out why I was having a problem. I was the only one who had a problem with his drinking. We would start getting in arguments. We never argued a lot in the very beginning of our marriage. I don't know where I got that from, my parents or not, because I didn't hear my parents argue. But we didn't argue a lot. I kind of went along with whatever he had to say or do for a long time. But I'm going to tell you, I got to be a lot different than that, and to end, as you'll know. But in the beginning, I didn't argue with him. I kind of went along with whatever he wanted to do and say, and accepted it real well for a while. But I could strive on his song, the 8 years and 2 children later, because I was right there in that spot. And I was wondering, I had a lot of doubts. I didn't believe in him, and things were creeping into my mind that I did not like. And I was having a hard time, and I didn't know it. And that another a country music song that used to really, I could hear it, and I could cry for a week over this one. It was A Good-Hearted Woman in Love with a Good-Timing Man. I cried and cried and cried over that one. So I listened to a lot of country music songs, as you can hear. When he was gone and he was drinking, that was my thing, especially those two, and a lot of others too. But life rocked on, and things weren't all bad. We took a lot of vacations. We did a lot of things I had not been used to as a little girl, and Billy made a lot of good money. He worked hard, and I worked hard too. I continued to work, and we had another little girl, and things were good at times, and things were bad at times. But I always thought that he was going to quit drinking. He just enjoyed it, and I knew one day he was going to settle down, and we were going to be happy ever after, just like my parents. He just had and this is a thing that really was a kicker for me. We were 18 years old when we got married. He didn't get to party and do the things that other guys got to do. He married so young. You know, he needed time, and he was going to get this out of his system, and then that's when we were really going to live. Well, he was 33 years old, and he was still doing the things that... And I wondered what was going to happen. not what's going to happen. I was really desperate by then. This was in 1975. The Pope just had it Holy Year. It was the whole year of the Holy Year. And I thought, I hope we never have another Holy Year, because 1975 was the worst year of my life. I hope I never have another one. But this time we had three children, and I were working hard, and we were not getting all the bills paid, and we were just paying the most important bills, and we've been married 15 years, and things weren't working out the way I had hoped for them to work out. I really had a hard time believing that he loved me anymore. I had a hard time believing that he was, you know, he wanted to be with someone else more than he wanted to be with me. He wanted these guys that was keeping him out. I always blamed everything on everybody else, everything else, because I believed that, you know, if he loved me enough, he would just stay home with me and do the things that I wanted him to do. And he wasn't doing any of those things. So I justified a lot of things for him. And I really, it really kept me afloat, I guess, for a while. I wouldn't have never done all the things that I did if he hadn't done all the things he did. So that was a biggie for me. You know, I did that because he did what he did. But this time, we were verbally abusing each other. And I hated what I had become, but I didn't know what else to do. I was doing sneaky things, you all. I were lying. I was calling a jail and a hospital, and I was calling other people, see if they had seen him. And I would put these little babies to bed at 8 o'clock. Then I would walk the floor. I would look out the window, watch for him. I was a car watcher, and then I would jerk these babies up out of the bed about midnight and put them in the car and haul them around town to see if I could see where he was and who he was with and what he was doing. So I did a lot of insanity things in alcoholism. The only thing I feel like I'm truly glad that God blessed me that I didn't leave those children at home. I hear a lot of stories from this podium where they left and went looking for their husband and left those children at home. I always put them in the car and hauled them around town. I don't know that they ever knew where they were going or what was happening, but I would wake them up in the middle of the night and put them in the car with me and haul them around town to see where he was. I was so afraid. I was so afraid of him that he was going to beat me home before I got home. Now, I don't know how sick that you can really get, but I really thought every time that he was going to be home when I got back from looking for him. But he never was, and I never found him either. So, but I looked for him a lot. But in 1975, we started talking about divorce, and that it was like the weather, you know, every day. I'm going to do this, and you can do that, and I'm going to. It was just, that's the only thing I knew to say to him. I didn't tell him when the children were going to have things, because I didn't want him with us. I didn't want him to go to any of their functions for school. I did all the things. I dropped three children off at three different places, picked them up at three different times. I did all the things. I never informed him of anything that went on. I mean, he was just a vegetable in our house because he never got to know anything. I never informed him or took him any place. But this time, church was out of the question. We used to go to church together and did things with the children together, but I didn't do anything with him anymore. I didn't want to be with him. I didn't want to be embarrassed anymore. I didn't want to do all those things that happened during alcoholism. I had no idea that what was going on. By this time, my family had sold the family farm, and they had moved to Nelson County. My mother wanted to come back where she was brought up, you know, grown up at, and be with her family. So my father was an orphan, and he didn't have a lot of family. So they sold the farm and bought a house and lot in near Bargetown. So they were coming by the house a lot, and they were seeing a lot of things I didn't want my parents to know. It was a sad day for me when I had to say what was going on in our life and tell my mother and father that my husband drank too much and that I didn't know where he was most of the time. Now, my mother said to me, "Now, Marietta, you don't know what you're talking about. There's nothing so great that two people can't sit down and talk about if they want to work it out." Now, for mother and daddy, that worked fine because mother did everything daddy wanted her to do. But I had done that. I had preached a many a sermon. I'd done a many a thing. I told him all the things he must be doing as a father and a husband, and he should just do them. Only thing I knew to do was what I was taught to do and what I saw in other people. And that's what I thought that was the way he was should do it. But I didn't know that all the things, I could not see all the things that I was doing to myself for a long time. But anyway, I knew my mother did not know what she was talking about. So it was in early August that year. It might have been the first day of August, but it was in the first week of August that year in 1975. And my husband had been out drinking all night long. And he came home 5:30 in the morning, and he had been to talk to our pastor. Now, we had wore a lot of people out trying to get help. We didn't know we was searching for help, but he came home and told me he was going to Our Lady Peace Hospital. Now, I had no idea what Our Lady Peace Hospital in Louisville was, but I knew it was a place for people with troubled minds. And I thought my husband did have a troubled mind, and that if those doctors would just tell him what to do, he would do it, and everything would be all right. I had thought about everything that would stop his drinking, and nothing seemed to work for me, but I had never thought about that, and I thought that was really going to be the answer. Because we both had been to our pastor, and we had gave him that long, sad tale that we all give each of our pastors when we go. And I remember the poor old Father Giesler, he said, "Now, Marietta, I don't know what's good for Billy, but I know one thing. As long as you live with him, you're bound to go to heaven." And I thought, by golly, I'm doing penance. I thought I was doing penance. So for a long time I stayed on doing penance. So I thought I was offering them up for my poor soul, I guess. But anyway, it didn't stay very long. It didn't last all that long. But anyway, in Bardstown, just this past October, they had celebrated 50 years anniversary of their Alcoholics Anonymous group. Now, I did not know there was any hope or any help for us, but they had an AA meeting going on in Bardstown and an Al-Anon group at the same time. And I had no idea that there was anything that could help us because, you know, they really kept things secretly years ago. I'm telling you, you didn't know there was an AA meeting going on. But anyway, I thought there was no hope for us, and I thought this was the last straw if he'd just go to Our Lady Peace. He went to Our Lady Peace, and he was there around 10 days, and I remember it was one Friday afternoon, and I came home from work. And there he was, sitting at our dining room table, and he was as drunk as he was when he left, or even drunker. I don't know. I thought he was as drunk as a skunk, and however drunk a skunk can get. I used to say it that way, but I never did really know how drunk they could get. But he was pretty drunk. I asked him how he got home, and he told me how he got home. I don't want to tell you what he said, but anyway, he got home. By the way, I didn't want him to get home. And I started screaming and yelling and cussing. Oh, anything, I thought the roof might just jump up and down any moment. That's how bad I was. And by this time, I wanted my parents to really know what was really going on, that I was not lying, and I was telling the truth about what was going on. So I jerked those three little children up and took them to well, they weren't little by then. They were like 13 and 10 and 7, 6 by then. And I took them to my parents' home and told them that we had been into a big argument, that I had not finished the argument, and I was going home and finishing it. When I got home, I just picked up where I left off, only we got into a real physical fight. That I don't know that I smacked him first or he smacked me, because I was a real good smacker. And I'm here to say I probably could have done the first, because if you back anybody up against the wall, they're going to smack you. And I backed him up against the wall a lot. I really did. But anyway, I had a next-door neighbor that Not only was she nosy, but I told her a lot of things. She saw. She saw a lot. And I remember telling her, she knew what was going on, so I remember telling her, and she saw that we were fighting, and she said to me, "Why don't you just have him locked up?" I never thought about having him locked up. I said, "Well, how do you do that?" Between the two of us, we went and had him locked up that night. And he spent the first night, he was 33 years old, in jail. The next morning, they had a little hearing over at the courthouse when you have your husband locked up. And I remember going in the courthouse, and there he was. Well, I need to say that morning before I went to the courthouse, I went over to the lawyer, and I sued him for divorce. I had saved me some money. And I had a hard time saving money, but I knew divorce was only the answer down the line. But I had to have some money to do it with, and I hid them in the drawer where my underwear was. I knew he wouldn't be looking for it there, and I could have some money saved. So that's where I hid all my money when I wanted to save some, because I knew he wouldn't look there. And I got my money and went to the lawyer, and I sued him for divorce. And they served the papers on him while he was in jail. And I remember going to that courthouse and seeing him stand upside that wall. He had no belt in his pants, no shoelaces in his shoes, and I thought he looked so pitiful. That would be a good word. Now, I didn't know when you went to jail they took your belt away from you and your shoelaces and all those things they take away from you, but he was really a sad-looking character. But my heart just sunk to my feet. I thought I couldn't stand him. And he asked me if I would go over to the courthouse, now the drugstore across from the courthouse, and buy him a pack of cigarettes. Now, if I had hated him like I thought I hated him, there's no way that I could have ever went over and bought him a pack of cigarettes, but I did. I thought I hated him because he wouldn't be doing the things he did to me. There's no way I could possibly love this man. Well, we were separated for 4 months. A lot of things happened in this 4 months that I had no comprehension of what might happen to me. First of all, I thought I was going to be free. I didn't have to listen to this alcoholic. I didn't have to be bothered with him no more. You don't get rid of an alcoholic because you divorce him. You just don't get rid of him. I thought I was going to have some fun. And my life was going to be a bed of roses for a few months anyway. Well, anyway, this next-door neighbor seemed to think that I ought not sit over there and play around and do around and moan around and all those things, cry and wonder where he was and what he was doing. I ought to get out and have some fun for myself. And I thought it was a pretty good idea myself. So I did a lot of things that I'm not proud that I did in that time in our life. I was so lonely that I believe a dog would have come along and licked me on the cheek. I'd been very grateful because I really, truly was. It was a sad, lonely time in my life because I thought I had lost my husband to another woman, another place, another thing. But since I came to Al-Anon and AA, I realized that and learned from you people that I'd lost my husband to a bottle of booze a long time ago, that he had a love affair going on with a bottle of booze, and he had no control and had no way of getting out of that bottle, and we did not know it, and I did not know it for a long time. I know today, since coming to Al-Anon and AA, that it just goes hand in hand, and I'm grateful to know that today. It helps me with the days that I'm having a hard time. But it wasn't long after that we separated that he was coming to the door and he was saying things like, "I want to come home. I want to know what I can do to come home and that I love you." That was just music to my ears. I had waited a few years to hear that. It had been a while since I had heard those words. And I wanted to hear them so bad. But I thought if I would just make him stay away from home, the longer I make him stay away, the better boy he was going to be when he got home. So I thought if I punished him long enough, he was just going to be a perfect guy when he came home. I remember telling him if he did not drink anymore, he could come home. And I did not know drinking was a problem for a long time. I thought it was other people, places, and things that was giving us our problem. If those people would get out of our lives and we had enough money and all those things I thought was happening, I thought we would be just fine. On Christmas Eve in 1975, I had told my parents and told my siblings that I was going to go and let Billy come back home. And they assured me if I let him come back home, that I would be taking the same old thing I always had lived with and that I needed not let him come home. But I loved him so much, and I had been with him for so long for Christmas, I just knew that I had to have him home for Christmas, if nothing else. Well, I went to my sister's, and I got a half a pint of vodka, and I started drinking. And when I drank enough, I told our oldest daughter to call her father and tell him to come home, to come get us. And he did, and he's been home ever since. That was Christmas in 1975. So I would love to tell you that everything has been great since then, and that we did, the drinking did stop, but that wasn't the way it was. A lot of things happened for the next 3 years. And after we went back together for the next 3 years, I thought things couldn't get any worse, that they had got to as bad as they could get. They couldn't get any worse. But I'm here to tell you that they got worse, and I had no idea. First of all, he told me that old house that we were living in, if we would just sell it and buy a new house, and we could leave all our troubles there and start anew. I was a very sick person, and I believed that. It sounded good, and I wanted to believe that more than anything on earth. I thought it was great that we could start anew and get our life back together and be back where we once was. 2 weeks, on the 17th day of January, it's about 3 weeks, I guess, we had sold that old house, and we had bought a new house, and we had got into this new house. And we had a house payment, twice the payment that we'd had in the old house. And he was back doing his thing, and I was doing mine. It was just crazy. I mean, it's just like we had just not stopped. It just got worse. That's all it was to it. For the next 3 years, I don't know when things happen. I was just crazy. I didn't know from one day to talk about living one day at a time. I didn't know from one day to the next where we were going to have food. I didn't know where we were going to pay the bills. We never paid all of them. We just paid the most important one. I didn't know the children found an outlet for their lives. We moved into a subdivision where they could find friends to go when things got bad. The children would meet me in the driveway when I got home from work. They'd say, "Mama, Daddy's drinking." And they would go where they wanted to go and did the things they wanted to do. They grew up like weeds. They had no supervision. You know, if he wanted them to do something, I surely didn't want them to do it. If I wanted them to do it, he surely didn't want to do it. So we fought a lot about the children. We fought about everything. We just fought. And I had went that divorce route, and I knew I didn't want to go there anymore. It wasn't what I thought it was going to be. For me, it was not. And I know we always have to have an outlet. We couldn't live from one day to the next if we didn't have some hope of some kind. And the only hope that I knew I had at the time was I knew that SOB was going to drink himself to death, and I thought the sooner the better. Any day would be all right. And that was the only thing I could live for, was that he was going to drink himself to death, and that I was going to have that house, I was going to get his Social Security for the children, and we're going to live happy ever after. I planned his funeral. I got his pallbearers, and everything was intact. I was just waiting for the day. It came the time when he was drinking so bad. I mean, he was really, really worse than I'd ever seen him. And he had been visiting a lot of the doctors in town, and he accumulated a few Valiums, and he had taken all of them, and they rushed him to the hospital. And he was in intensive care in Louisville at the Baptist Hospital. And the next morning, I went in to see him, and he was so weak he couldn't even set up or stand up. And I leaned over and I kissed him on his forehead. And he said, "Oh, Marietta, I wished you meant that." Got in my throat as big as my fist, and I absolutely thought I was going to die before I got to the door to get my breath. Because when he came home, I didn't bother to tell him I loved him, that I was glad he was home, that I wanted him to work things out. You know, it had been a long time since I had said those words and to mean anything, that to have any hope at all for him. And I remember how hard that was for me to get my breath to get to the door. It's another thing that happened along. Well, what I wanted to say was, that I didn't say, was that I had hoped that that was going to be our answer. It was going to be my answer to my prayer, that he was going to die and get out of my life. And when he almost did, I knew that day that I didn't want him to die, that I knew that I loved him and I wanted things to be better for us. And I wanted to try to work things out. Another thing that happened that I want to tell you about that happened in this 3-year period was every time that we would get into an argument or we would have a disagreement or things weren't going my way, I'm going to tell you what really happened. I would run down to my parents' home and take those children because he didn't want me to go. And the more he didn't want me to do something, I was surely going to do that. So I did it a lot more than I needed to do it. But I remember my father saying to me, "You know, Marietta, we can't not stand your mother and I. We are really having a hard time with you coming down here. And we never know when to eat or when to watch TV, or we can't do anything because we never know when you're coming with the children and upsetting us. That we just live in a chaos life, and we don't want you to have to live like that. You're going to have to stay with him, or you're going to have to stay with us." Now, my father always spoke the gospel. I really believed he did. And I knew he wasn't going to tolerate me no more. That was going to be the end of that. But Daddy said something to me that really stood out that night. He said, "You know, Marietta, if you had an old iron skillet, if you would just set it on the stove, and when he came in drinking, just lay him out with that skillet, and he won't drink no more." When he came in drinking, and I remember what my father said, I ran into the kitchen, and I remember there wasn't any skillet sitting on my stove, but I opened the cabinet drawer, and there laid a rolling pin. I ran in there with that rolling pin, and I hit him in the head with that rolling pin. Blood just flew up the wall. He must have been a free bleeder because it went all over the floor, all over the couch. It went on the lampshade. It blew up it just squirted up the wall. I mean, it was everywhere. I really thought that I had killed him. I really did. And I think he thought that I was going to kill him too, because since sobriety and some Al-Anon in our home, we have thought about this day a lot. And we really believe that it stopped the physical violence in our home, but it didn't stop the drinking, but we stopped physically beating up on each other at this time, I think, because I can't remember ever hitting him after that, because I was really afraid of myself, afraid of what I might kill him next time. But anyway, in 1979 was when we came to the program of AA and Al-Anon. After AA, it was in Derby Day in 1979 that my husband had been out partying, and he was having a good time. And in Kentucky, you all know the Derby Day is a big time and a big party day for a lot of us, and it was for him too. And he got locked up and put in jail, and they told him the next morning if he could go and stay in jail for 6 more months or he could go to treatment. There had been a lot of wrecks, a lot of DUIs, and a lot of things, and a lot of jails happened up to this point. But I had no idea about treatment and what it was all about until this point. But when he went to treatment, as you know, he chose that instead of jail. He went to treatment for 30 days. And while he was there a couple of weeks, I went there to see him. And he had the most beautiful brown eyes. They were so clear, and I hadn't seen them that clear in a long time. And he told me he'd been going to AA. Now, I did not want to know anything about AA, because I'd heard a little bit about that from the Reader's Digest or somewhere I had read. Those people help each other when they got in trouble with their drinking, and I didn't want to be bothered with AA. But he told me he'd been going to AA and that he might be coming home this weekend for the weekend, and that we could go to a meeting if I wanted to over at Elizabethtown, which is 26 miles from Bardstown. Now, I didn't want to go to no AA meeting, but I thought, well, we'll go to Elizabethtown, and nobody from Bardstown will know we're going to that old AA meeting. And when he came home and we went to the meeting, and I'll never forget it as long as I live. And I hope everybody in this room listens to the newcomer that comes, because when I came down those steps, I thought I'd do my wifely duty and support him in his habit and what was going on in his life. So I thought we would go and sit on the back row and nobody would know we were there. But we came down them church steps, and I thought they truly had formed a receiving line for us. I really believed that, because it was one right after the other for a long time, and they would shake our hands and say, "We're glad you're here." And I remember how important that was for me, because I felt so good and so warm. And I just felt like these people just love each other so much. Look how they hugging on each other. They care about each other. And I hadn't seen that in a long time. I never seen that in a family, as much as I thought my family loved each other. And we still tell each other we love each other. And we hug each other. And I never seen that. Like, I felt that you all cared for each other. And it was important. You all were important to each other. But I remember that night, I stayed in the AA meeting with him. And of course, I didn't know anything about Al-Anon at this time, but I remember this little old room. These ladies were going in and out of this room like bees were going in and out of a hive. You know, they just going in and out, in and out. And I punched my husband, and I said, "What are those ladies going? Where are they?" He said, "Well, they're going to Al-Anon." "What's Al-Anon?" He said, "That's for the friends and the families of the alcoholic." First thing I ever knew about there was anything for friends and families of alcoholics. But something just danced in my mind that night, because this alcoholic, when we came down those steps, he asked me if I was an alcoholic. Oh, it made me mad. How dare him? I let him know who the alcoholic was, and it wasn't me. It surely wasn't me that night. But I remember him saying, and I know this alcoholic had seen a lot of people like me come down them steps, because he said, "If you can't smell them, you can't tell them." It's a good answer for me. And I really believe you can't smell them, you can't tell them. It's true, very true. But anyway, that night I made my mind up, well, next week I'm going to Al-Anon, because that way they'll know who the alcoholic is. It's not going to be me. I don't know why you want to go to Al-Anon for that, but that was the ideal I went on, just so they would know who the alcoholic was. But in Al-Anon, I said for the next 8 weeks, I went every Saturday night for the next 8 weeks. Also, I went to my home group, which I have now, on Thursday night in Bardstown. I went to that meeting, and I went to Al-Anon thinking that they would know who the alcoholic was. Now, I thought your stories and your comments was just great, because, see, your alcoholic was still drinking, and mine's out there in AA, and he's sober, and he's doing all those right things, and these don't apply to me, because I do all the right things, and he did all the wrong things, and I justified everything I did, and I just thought I was just Miss Perfect. That's all it was to it. That's how I was. But after 8 weeks, my husband chose to drink again, and no wonder he drank again, but thank God that he has all these plans in our life, because I know those are the stumbling blocks that he gives us to get stepping stones for him, because that's what happens to me. Because I went back to them Al-Anon groups, and I asked him what I could do about his drinking. They told me I couldn't do anything about his drinking. Boy, I was crushed really then, because the only thing I could do about his drinking was to help myself. That was a blow to my head, because I did not know that I could do anything to to make me more perfect than I really was. But it took me 2 years in the Al-Anon program to get this program. I believe if you're a family member, if they're still drinking out there and you're coming to Al-Anon, that you have to work the program the hardest. Because it was those 2 years that I had to struggle. Some days I didn't have much to work with, and some days I had a lot. Some days I could do real good with this program. I could do a lot of things that I never thought I was capable of doing. I learned to see things in a different way that I never thought I could in the next 2 years because I struggled with this program. My husband continued to drink. He continued to come to AA. We continued to go to conference. We went every night in the week, no matter where he was drunk or sober. We did a lot of AA and Al-Anon in those 2 years. There was a lot more sober time than were drinking time, and it was a lot of good times in our life. It was a lot better than it had ever been, and I was beginning to get a life for my own. I got a sponsor. She was a lady that had started our home group, and she was really good for me. I checked in on her on a daily basis because I just didn't know. She explained a lot of things to me that I had no idea what was, you know, like, what Odette? You all would say Odette, our Odette book. I didn't know it was a one day at a time book. Y'all just cut it short. But see, I wouldn't dare ask you what that meant because I didn't want to be, you know, I didn't want to be that. I did not know. And sobriety, and you talked about words that I didn't have no meaning to. I'd get the dictionary and look up a lot of them, and a lot of them I didn't know how to spell, so it was a lot of things that I had to learn. It was hard for me to catch on because I wouldn't ask for a long time. But when I got this sponsor, and that's what they're really for, I'm just telling you in a general way what happened to me. I didn't tell you no glory details, but my sponsor knew some glory details that's not going to be told at this podium, so that's what they're for. I did a lot of things that really did. I learned that no matter what I did, that I don't do them today, that I only live one day at a time, that's the best I can do, and today's all I got. And I don't do those things no more. And I'm so grateful for that I learned that. I also went through the steps. She helped me to do the steps. And back then, the only way I knew how to do it was to write my life history in a story way from the day that beginning to as far back as I could remember. That is the best I could do. Now, I have done it since then in a resentment way, writing all my resentments into four columns, and I'm going to tell you it did a thorough job for me, and I'm real comfortable with that. I learned that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life was unmanageable and that I could have a God and that, you know, he could restore me to sanity. I learned how to turn my will and my life over to a God and to believe that he was going to take care of me. And after the fourth and fifth step, I felt so that no matter what I had done, I was going to be okay, that I was a good person, and learn how to, that I did have defects of character and shortcomings, and I didn't know they were existed. So I learned from you all, but listened to you, that I too had defects of characters and shortcomings. I also learned to make a list of people to make amends to, and I don't want to hurt other people. I feel like that I've done enough hurting to other people, and to learn that not to hurt other people was a real biggie for me because I don't want to make amends to people that will hurt them or do my benefit. I learned that, and I was so grateful for that. Because there is a few on my amend list I have not made amends to, and I don't want to hurt them anymore, so I'm not going to upset their lives. That's just all it is to it. And I learned to be okay with that in the program. And the 10th, 11th, and step, or the 10th, 11th, and 12th steps are very important in my life. They're a daily thing that I do when I meditate of a morning and redo my readings. And when I'm wrong, I want to promptly admit it as soon as I possibly came to realize that I've done wrong. Because I don't want that ucky feeling I feel in that hole in my gut. And I don't want to, when I lay down at night, to feel that I've done something wrong that day to hurt someone. If I do, I want to write it. I want it to be right with them and right with me. So, and learn to do that was really been powerful. And I love helping other people. I like what Jim said at the meeting the other night. He said, angels, there's a lot of angels in it, Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon. When we help one another and we care for one another, and that's what I get from the 12 step. Well, I'd like to tell you that everything's been smooth ever since I got into Al-Anon, but God sends me a lot of troubles to fashion my life for better things. He really does. That's what today's reading is, and the courage to change. He says that very thing. My husband did find a year of sobriety, and I remember the last day he drank, I don't think it's the last day he drank, but when I found out where he was, he'd been gone a couple of days, and he called me and wanted to come home. Now, any other time, I would say, oh, honey, where are you? How can I come and get you? When do you want me to come and get you? And I didn't say that. I said, oh, I've got a district meeting I've got to go to. I've got an Alateen conference I've got to go to. And it was a different story when he said, well, when can you come get me? And I'm so grateful I had got to that point that my life counted. And I didn't know that for a long time. But I did end up going and getting him and bringing him home late on Sunday night. And he's been sober ever since. He really has. We've had a good life together since he's been sober and I've been in Al-Anon. But we have continued to do those things or we wouldn't have a good life. And not everything's been okay, but we are okay. The first year of sobriety he had, I thought we would die. Because, see, we wanted to know too much. We wanted to know every glory detail. And when we learn that it's not important for us to have to know, we got better. I lost my job the first year of sobriety, and I didn't have a drink. But I lost two jobs since he's been sober. I was so grateful for the first job I had for 21 years that it kept us afloat, that we kept on eating and bills got paid. But as soon as he got sober and I lose a job, see, I just see God working in my life and taking care of me when I needed it the most. Because after he got sober and we got some bills paid, it wasn't as important that I had a job. I work today because I want to, not because I have to, and that's a big difference. I have a lot of wants yet, and that's a big difference in my life from having to do things. But every time that I lost a job, I got a better job, I made more money. And see, God don't shut one door without opening another one for me, and he's done it all. And I can see how he works in my life. Even during the hard times, I see how, and even today, I can see how he works in my life. After my husband was sober 5 years, I was told I had a malignant cancer, and I ended up having a mastectomy. I remember coming down I-65 that morning, coming to Bargetown from Louisville at the Norton's Hospital, that's where I was, and I told my husband, I said, I'm not going to go home and tell anybody that I've got a cancer. I'm going to tell my mother that I've got a tumor and they're going to take it out and la, la, la. And he looked over at me and he said, now, Marietta, you tell them anything you want to tell them, but I'm going to tell them the truth because we're going to need their prayers. And boy, that was the way it was for a long time. A long time. I thought I could not accept this. I just really had a hard time. It was a long time before I could come around. I remember I came home and I called the first Al-Anon I called, the first person I called, because she was a nurse. I know why I called her. Then I called Juanita. Now, Juanita wasn't my sponsor at that time. She's my sponsor today because my first sponsor has passed away in 1992. I needed a sponsor long before she passed away because she died of cancer, but I couldn't get one as long as she lived. And as soon as she died, I went to the 31 group in Louisville, and there was Juanita. And I knew I had to have a sponsor, so I asked her at the coffee pot, and she said yes, because I've used her so much since then. Not like I'd like to. I don't use her like I need to. But I when I'm in bad times, I mean, I know what to do. And I'm glad I know that what to do. But I remember calling her because the reason I called Juanita, we were speaking in Jasper, Indiana the following weekend, and I said, what do they do? We've got to cancel out because I'm having surgery on Tuesday. She said, well, they usually have a backup speaker. You can go on and call and tell them. And so I did, and I even suggested a couple for them to call, and they called them and had the couple to come and speak. But I remember speaking to her about that very day. But the first thing that happened to me when the doctor told me that I did have a cancer and that they were going to do surgery, I thought, oh, God, you know, he's only been sober 5 years, and I want more of his sobriety than that, because I'd waited a long time for him to be sober, and I thought I deserved more than that. I was so in what was going to happen to me than what was really truly happened to me. And I remember when Juanita called me at the hospital, and I guess I was whining. I don't remember what I did say, but I was telling her something, and she said, now, Marietta, no matter what, you're going to be okay. If you have treatments or what, no matter what happens, and I didn't know I was going to be okay. And I remember her saying it, and I thought that was so powerful for her to tell me that. And it wasn't long, I did come around and ask God to help me, because, see, I couldn't ask God to help me, because I was just thinking about, well, I know I'm gonna die, and Billy's going to do this and do that. And, you know, I was thinking about the kids that's going to do this and do that, and I'm not going to get to enjoy his sobriety. That was the thing I thought. And things were good for us, and we did a lot of things in AA and Al-Anon. We went to a lot of things and was with a lot of good people and met a lot of people. But in 1990, my husband was elected the delegate for the state of Kentucky, and I went to New York with him. Now, I'm telling you, Alcoholics Anonymous do their spouses of the alcoholic royalty in New York. I got to see things and do things that this poor little old country girl never thought was opportunity for me. And it's only through the alcoholic. I said, nowhere but Alcoholics Anonymous would this ever happen to anybody. And I mean, it was free. It was wonderful. It was just wonderful. We had a good time, and I met people all over the world. Thought it never would happen to me. I thought we were at our highlights. We were at the greatest we could ever get in Alcoholics Anonymous. This or in Al-Anon. There's no doubt in my mind. It is just wonderful. In 1994, I was elected the Al-Anon delegate for the state of Kentucky, and I went to New York. I went to the World Service Office, and on this big map on the wall, they have a map of Canada and the United States, and under Kentucky, it had Marietta Manningly. I thought I would just die. I just cried and cried that all those good people back in Kentucky thinks I'm worthy enough to go to the World Conference and represent them. It was I thought I couldn't get any better, but I'm telling you, I was here to tell you, it got a lot better for me. It was wonderful. Well, I'm going to tell you about our children, and I'm going to shut up, because I know you're getting tired, and you need a cigarette or go to the bathroom. All our children are grown today, and they're adult children. Thank God they're all adults, and Billy and I are all by ourselves, and things are going pretty good for us today. Now, all summer long, we've had a hard time. We've sold the house that we lived in for 22 and a half years, and we bought a bigger house and a much nicer house. A lot of good things happened in this time, but next door to my mother-in-law, and Billy's going to inherit his mother's estate, so it made it nice that we had found a real nice house that we wanted right next door in the back of her, so it's wonderful. But we had a lot of testy moments this summer. We had never moved for 22 and a half years, and we had moved during alcoholism, and I don't remember the move. I swear I don't remember how we moved, but we got there somehow. But moving this time was just, it was, I said things I didn't think I would ever say. And I was always teed at him no matter what, you know. He wanted to put it here or put it there, and I wanted it there. You know, we've had a lot of testy moments, but it's getting better, and things are looking up, so we're doing okay on that part. But our oldest daughter was the hardest, and she took the brunt of the alcoholism. I was in Al-Anon 11 years before that she ever told me she was glad I went to Al-Anon. She married during alcoholism, and she was just barely out of high school. And I know today she married to get away from her drunken father and her bitching mother. It was just awful to live like she had to live. And when she told me that she was so happy that we went to Al-Anon and Daddy went to AA and we were doing the things we were doing, it was one of our anniversaries. I can't remember. I think it was around the 30th. But I remember telling her that we weren't going to do anything exciting and that we needed to, we were going to Mass that morning and that all the children could go with us and we would go out to Holiday Inn and we would buy the breakfast for them. And she said, "Oh, Mama, I'm so proud of you and Daddy, that you all stayed together and you worked things out." And tears just rolled down my cheeks and it hit, I remember having my gown and robe on and it just hit the floor. It was just a pile of water at the floor. And I was just, it was just, and when she quit talking, she talks a lot like I do. And when she quit talking, she said, "Mama," it was just dead silence on the phone. And the only thing I could say back to her was, "Me too, San." It was just wonderful to wait that long. I had to wait that long to know that she really cared and really was happy that we did go to the program. Our middle child is truly a middle child. He's had a lot of problems. It hasn't been alcoholism, but he's had a lot of problems and done a lot of things that he's had a hard time in life. He really has. He's doing good today, but it was really hard then. And this was when my sponsor died. She died in September, and I asked Juanita to be my sponsor about 3 weeks later, I think it was. So I went to the meeting and asked her, because Christmas that year, he went to Gatlinburg in Tennessee, somewhere down here, and he married a little girl at one of those little love chapels. When I found out the hard way that he was going to marry this little girl, I really had a lot of things to say to him. You know what we do when we children are doing things that we know that they're going to have a lot of pain in their life. And I said a lot of things that to try to get him to change his mind and to wait and to be careful with what he was. It was a big step in life. And you know all the things we mothers say to our children when we're trying to get them not do something that we want them not to do. And when I found out that what I said did not count, Al-Anon taught me to just shut up and let him feel his pain, and I did. Because in March of that year, I had went to the area assembly. I was a treasurer, I think, then at the area assembly. I remember coming home, two Al-Anons dropped me off at the house, and I met Billy coming up the driveway, and I said, "Did y'all have a nice weekend?" He said, "We had a hell of a weekend." And I could tell on the look of his face that something dreadful must have happened while I was gone. And he told me that our son's little ex-wife, by that time, because he did get a divorce after being married a couple months to her, had stabbed him, and they had flew him staff helicopter into Louisville at the University Hospital. I didn't ask. The next thing I said, "Well, where is he?" And he told me where he was at. I knew he wasn't dead, that he was okay. He would probably be all right. But at that very moment, after I said that very word, I wanted to kill her. I wanted to kill that little girl more than anything in my life. I really did. And I thought, "You've been in Al-Anon for 16 years. Why do you want to do that? Why do you feel the way you do?" But I remember calling Juanita. I don't think I called her that day. I think it was on a Monday. I wasn't working. I know the next day I didn't work. And I called her, and she told me if I couldn't put, I wanted to go talk to her. I wanted to go tell her. I don't know what I wanted to tell her, but I really wanted to go. I wanted to say something to her, I know, but I don't know what it was at the time. But she told me if I couldn't put all my resentments in a bag and throw them in a ditch, not to go. Well, I couldn't do that. In no way I could ever do that. Well, I never got to go. I thank God I never got to go. And today I don't ever think about that little girl. But I'm going to tell you, I can say God bless her. And that's a far piece from wanting to kill her. And I really am grateful to the program for that. Our youngest, she's a happy child. She's just had a brand new baby. Well, he's 10 months old. He's not brand new, but boy, it's good for a family to have a baby. We got a baby in our family, and we just love him, and he's just so much fun in our life. But she married during sobriety, and we had a lovely wedding, and a lot of you were there, and it was wonderful. And we planned the wedding. We spent a lot of money, but it was worth it, and we just had a good time. We went out to eat and did a lot of things that I didn't think was going to be possible for us to do. And I'm just grateful for that today. We ate out a lot, and I remember one time I was telling her about when in 1960 in the Catholic Church at the end of the wedding ceremony, the bride would take her bridal bouquet and she would place it on the altar of the Blessed Virgin. And I was sharing that with her, and you know that when she got married, they don't do that today, but she did that, and that was really meaningful for me. So I know that she really does, am grateful and happy that we go to AA and Al-Anon and that we're together and we work things out. Because she stayed home a long time. She was the one that stayed home and really enjoyed the sobriety in the Al-Anon program. I want to close with this little thought that where I'm at in my program and how I feel about the program. I feel like the little boy that's been praying to God for a long, long time for a brand new shiny bike. And all the time, God had a Cadillac in mind for him. Thank you all, and God bless you.